Gifford Pinchot, who was the founding chief of the Forest Service, was a remarkable figure in American history. So remarkable is he that it required for me a 15-year-long journey of working through his papers and thinking about his life and trying to understand what, in fact, he had actually accomplished, both as the chief of the Forest Service, later as a governor of Pennsylvania, and finally as a human being. What is it that this man achieved, and how did he go about doing so? To understand some of those questions, we really have to remember that as a child of parents, it was his parents which very much shaped him. And I don't think I have ever run into parents like his. Mary Eno Pinchot and James Pinchot were remarkable figures within the family dynamic, and I suspect they're remarkable in any respect. They saw in their son something great, something grand. They believed he could be someone greater than most people are. I don't know why they thought that, except that they were ambitious for their children, or certainly ambitious for Gifford. And it's remarkable when you think about that element of a parent's life. We all look at our own children. We all think they're great. We try to do for them better than what our parents perhaps did for us. But this is a story in which not only did they think about it, not only did they try it, but they actually achieved it, which in itself is really quite a remarkable accomplishment. So let me start with Gifford's parents, tell you a bit about them, because they ultimately are the source from which the son would come. James Pinchot's family is French in origin. They arrived in the United States in the early 19th century. In fact, we can date it even more explicitly than that. When Napoleon fell at Waterloo, the Pinchots left France, which tells you something about their political allegiances. They were very much supporters of Napoleon and the great ambitions that he had for France as the dominant force in Europe, and sided with him. In fact, one of the stories is that Gifford's great-grandfather was to have raised a regiment to march to Waterloo to fight with Napoleon, but didn't quite get there in time. Probably a little foot dragging was probably the right decision, because Napoleon got obliterated at Waterloo. When he returned back to France, it was very clear that the tide had turned, that the Bonapartists were on the run, and as Bonapartists, the Pinchots had to run, and they ran all the way to Milford, Pennsylvania. Not the normal designation, but they went there because there was already a French emigre colony clustered around Milford where French was spoken. And the Pinchot family arrived with money. They were well off, and they were able to bring with them, unlike most immigrants in American history, some capital and some wealth and standing which would allow them to purchase land and to begin a new life in the New World. And they did. They did very, very well by themselves. The Milford that they entered was a small frontier town. Even though it's in the early 1800s, it still was a frontier community. And what Gifford's great-grandfather and then grandfather would do as they evolved in their lives was to nestle into this hilly, rocky terrain in eastern Pennsylvania and see in this very rich land, though it was not rich agricultural land, by the way, an enormous amount of wealth that they could appropriate to themselves. And they did a couple of things, the first of which was to start to invest in wooded hillsides. And what do they do with that? They clear cut them. And they took the logs and flowed them down the Delaware River and its tributaries in the rain-swollen spring months to ride those log rafts that they bound together and sent down the Delaware to all of the river ports along the way. They would stop off, sell the logs as they could, and move on to different communities, to Trenton, to New Hope, and other places, depending on where they could make their market, and sell their goods and services along the way. And then walk back to town, because there was no other mechanism by which to get to Milford. And the cycle would start again. Clear cut, sell, bring out that profit. And what profit they made, they poured back into more land purchases. Slowly, bit by bit, they began to level the forest of eastern Pennsylvania. That's important, as we will see in Gifford's life in a little bit. While they were doing that, though, they also had a corner store. They set up the first commercial enterprise, a general store, the four corners of streets in Milford, Pennsylvania, and served, therefore, as the commercial entity across whose counters flowed both farmers' goods that came into town and general goods that flowed out to the farmlands. And so the family was deeply involved in the commercial life of this small town, so much so that they became amongst the very first citizens of this town and ultimately would build not only a grand general store, but in the pattern of the time, in the 1830s, 1840s, they built a lovely Greek Revival home that still exists in Milford, Pennsylvania today, right at the Four Corners where the family first started. And so they really were the bedrock, the foundation of this community. James's father did very, very well. That's Gifford's grandfather, had done very, very well, so well that he was able to allow his children to leave that town. They didn't need to work with him to keep the family business alive. And so one by one, Gifford's father and aunts and uncles left Milford to find their way mostly to New York City, the great center of commerce in the United States. And at least two of them, Edgar and James, Edgar being Gifford's uncle, did marvelously well once they got to New York in their early 20s. James Pinchot took an interesting tact and made an enormous amount of money in a very short period of time at the precise moment in which New York City is exploding in its industrial growth in the 1850s and early 1860s before the Civil War. He invested in and began to sell wallpaper hanging. Now, that doesn't sound like an arena in which you can make a lot of money, but it turns out when there was a great deal of disposable income amongst the rising middle classes and upper classes of New York City as a consequence of the initial Industrial Revolution, you could make a ton of money. But he particularly specialized in selling goods like this to the new grand hotels that were being constructed in New York, one of which was called the Fifth Avenue Hotel, built by Richard Amos Eno, one of the greatest land speculators of the 19th century. In New York City. One of his children, Mary Eno, caught the eye of James Pinchot, and in the 1860s, they finally married. By marrying Mary Eno, James Pinchot, who was a wealthy man by this point, married into far greater wealth than he could have ever imagined having, or maybe he could imagine having it because he saw her, fell in love with her, and married her. Her father, Richard Amos Eno, I guess the analog would be Donald Trump. He built Broadway. He basically defined Broadway as a street, put his Fifth Avenue Hotel on it, and by the virtue of this hotel, which is going to sound strikingly modern, it had restaurants, it had broad promenades on the inside, it had boutiques, shops inside. It was the place to go to have lunch. It was gaudy, it was off the top, so maybe Vegas is a better analogy. But it drew people in like a magnet. In addition to drawing in consumers, it brought in the political powers that be. Every visiting Englishman and woman came to New York City. That was the hotel they stayed in. That's the hotel in which James and Mary Eno began their married life because the family had its own suite in the hotel. So the Pinchots and the Enos are all clustered in this remarkably luxurious environment. And it was here, I suspect anyway, that Gifford Pinchot was conceived, although he would be ultimately born at the Eno estate in Simsbury, Connecticut, from which Mary Eno's father had originally come. He was therefore born into, Gifford Pinchot was born into an amazing family who had, by both sides of the family, wrested their wealth out of a very good, rich land. One is an urban environment, the other is rural, but they are making very much of a good thing out of this new republic as it's being formed in the 1840s and 1850s and 1860s, so that when Gifford was born in 1865, he comes into this family with every virtue and benefit that could have possibly have come to him in that day and at that time. He grew up in the hotel. He spent his summers in Simsbury, Connecticut. He would also visit his father's family in Milford, where ultimately the family would build its summer cottage, as they called it, Gray Towers, one of the biggest cottages you will ever imagine with 39 bedrooms and the like. So cottage may be a misnomer, but they thought small about a big place. And that big place, it turns out, would become really important to him as a mark of his family's ascendance to significance in American society. But he also went to Europe with his family. And like most of us, he went to Europe for 3 years. Well, maybe not like most of us, but it's like how most of us should live, is to have the grand tour when he was a child, a small young man. Spent his time there learning French so well that really French became the first language of that household. And so early on understood that there was a greater world beyond the United States, understood very early on that his family moved in that world in a way that very few other people did. They had family portraits painted, which cost $10,000 in gold. So we're talking about serious cash in the 1860s and 1870s. And they began to buy fine goods and services from England, importing silver, importing china, importing linen, to sort of house themselves and basically surround themselves with the good things that Europe had to offer. So Gifford Pinchot didn't want for much in his life. In fact, he wanted for nothing, it's to be sure. And it's yet within that very luxurious and sustaining environment that his parents began to watch him and recognized immediately, not simply because he was the first child, though that's part of it, but they also began to recognize this kid had talents and he had interests. And they really sort of watched what he liked to do. And it turns out what he loved to do was to hang out in the woods, slop around the marshes, go after animals, study animals, think about animals, talk about animals endlessly. The parents got the hint. This kid liked to be outdoors. To be in an office would probably be the wrong place to place him. And so they began to consider alternative worlds for him in which that would shape his life over time. What's interesting about those sets of questions that they were asking themselves about their son as he came of age was that his grandfather, his mother's father, was asking similar questions about him, and he had a very different answer. He looked at Gifford Pinchot, saw a young man of great talent and success, and said to himself, and then said to Gifford, "I want this kid in my business." Had he gone into his father's business, I have no doubt that he would have made a ton of money and burnished the family's income even more largely than it was then at that time. But his parents intervened. His parents, who grew up in wealth, didn't want their son to make more wealth. That was a career that others had already done. His career would be something else, and it's an odd set of choices that these parents made. But I think the answer for why they wanted to do this lies in two sets of answers for why they wanted to do what they did. The first has to do with a small part of the American elite, which in the late 19th century argued that the making of money, while virtuous in its own way, was not all virtue, that there had to be something else going on, that there had to be another way by which a young man, and it was usually young men in that day, could add to the family's reputation. And for some of these, the Roosevelt family, the Pinchot family, and the Adams family, Henry Adams and the like of that same time period, reached the conclusion that public service was the key. Some kind of profession in the public arena would add much greater glory to the family than simply adding more money and more money and more wealth. Within the Pinchot family, the decision for Gifford to become a forester is even more peculiar because there was no such thing as a forester in the United States. The word wasn't even understood or known. So why would they choose that profession for their son, who admitted he didn't know anything about it either? The answer, I think, actually lies in the work that Gifford's grandfather, Cyril Pinchot, in Milford, Pennsylvania, had pursued. In one sense, and James Pinchot, the father, spoke of this, the family had basically cut over eastern Pennsylvania and then pursued land speculation ventures in other states around the country. And in a way, I think Gifford Pinchot was offered up as a kind of expiation for family sin. It had to make money, it had to do the things that it did, and that may, sin may be too strong a term for what they had pursued or what the consequences of their actions were. But as James Pinchot talked about it, what he wanted was his son to repair that which the family had destroyed. And that's striking. It's noblesse oblige in a sense. It's an argument that each generation tries to do better than the previous generation. And in this particular family, doing better than the previous generation meant not being a lumberman, not being involved in mercantile activity, but in fact, oddly and interestingly, in rehabilitating the landscapes that the previous generations had obliterated. And there's two sort of episodes that help us understand some of that. The first, and really it's a multi-set of events, turned around Gifford Pinchot's 21st birthday. On that birthday, the family not only celebrated his birthday, but also celebrated the opening of the Pinchot family new home, Gray Towers, situated on a bluff overlooking the Delaware River. From its porches, in fact, anywhere in that household, you could see the river because there were no trees there. There are extraordinary photographs that identify exactly how clear-cut this landscape was and also how badly eroded it had become because of the clear-cutting. And what James Pinchot wanted to do with that house was to rehabilitate the land around it, to put in more trees, to put in more gardens, to basically re-green what he had made brown. And he demonstrated his interest in that by the gift that the family gave to Gifford in the new house as they're opening up this new place, a gift that has tremendous significance. It was a gilt-edged copy of a book called Man and Nature by George Perkins Marsh. Now, most of us have not read George Perkins Marsh, and there's a reason for it. It's a tough book to read. It's also very long. And also, because it was written in the 1860s, we don't know much about Perkins Marsh. But we should, because he became the central force that began to identify the idea of conservation and land stewardship in the United States in the 1860s. So let me tell you a bit about Marsh as a way to understand why, when the family gave this present to Gifford, they were giving him much more than simply a book. George Perkins Marsh had been raised in Vermont and grew up in a landscape that, not unlike eastern Pennsylvania, that had been cut over, farmed in, grazed out, burned over, and basically devastated. His father took him along the streams of Vermont to teach him how to fish, but also told him there aren't as many fish in these rivers any longer than there was when I was growing up because of what we have done to the landscape. In short, he was passing on a message about ecological destruction, which then George Perkins Marsh had a national experience of when he became a diplomat and was sent overseas during the Civil War to represent the United States in Italy, and prior to that in Turkey. As he traveled the Mediterranean basin, Marsh began to recognize that what he had seen as a child in Vermont, he was witnessing of what had already happened under the Romans, under the Greeks, in Lebanon. There were no more cedars of Lebanon. Those had all been chopped down. And what he began to sense was that national power depended on natural resources, that if you destroy your natural resources, the state of which you were part, whether it's Vermont or the United States or Italy or Greece, would fall apart. And so Marsh wrote this book, Man and Nature, in which he made two central arguments. The first was an apocalyptic argument. The end is coming, the end is coming, the end is coming. And how did he know? He was looking at Italy. Its end was already there. And so he began to argue that, look, if we don't change, we will destroy ourselves. But he doesn't leave it at the apocalypse, because he assumes that human beings have the capacity to transform themselves and the landscapes that they exploit, that they utilize. And so then the closing section of this book was an argument for land stewardship, that the only way to turn our society around was to argue for a new form of land use, which form demanded a new kind of human behavior. We must become stewards on the land. And although he doesn't cite Genesis, he might as well have done, because there, embedded in that ancient text, is an argument about how human beings should be the stewards of the landscape, not the sole manipulators, but the stewards of it, because that's what keeps us. Today, the Forest Service describes itself as caring for the land and caring for the people, which is effectively the same set of arguments that Marsh made in the 1860s. We make sure that nature survives so that human beings will endure. When the family gave this book to Gifford Pinchot and handed it off to him on his 21st birthday, what I think they were telling him in so many words was, your calling as a forester is to take Marsh's arguments and apply it not to Milford, that's our job. Your job is then to expand it out to the nation. And as we'll see, Pinchot would take it even farther than that and argue for global rehabilitation by the 1930s and the 1940s. All of which is fine and good, but there's still no school for him to go to, no place for him to study this thing called forestry, of which there is nothing available in the United States. It helps that he spoke French, it helps that his family was rich, and it helped that they told him, go east, young man, head to Europe, which is what he then did. Got on a boat, sailed to Europe, went to England, and did a curious thing. He went into the colonial office of the English foreign policy wing of government in Whitehall. He went there because the British had been practicing forestry, not so much in England, but in India, their greatest colony of all. In fact, they had hired a German forester, a man named Dietrich Brandis, to be the man who managed their great forested plantations in India in the middle part of the 19th century. Immediately then, we see two things. First of all, they hired a German to manage forests in India under the colonial dominion of the English government. Forestry at its very beginnings was an international, global enterprise. The other is that Pinchot actually went and pursued this possibility. And there, when he was at Whitehall, getting the books that he wanted to get about English forestry practices so he could study this thing that he thought he wanted to become, he was asked if he wanted a letter of introduction to Sir Dietrich Brandis, then living in Bonn in Germany. Well, of course he did. He had the capacity to go, and so he went. And he met Brandis, and they spoke in French because that was their shared language. And Brandis sensed in Pinchot, very much as his parents had, is a young man of enormous talent. But he was an American, even better. And he could become Brandis's American acolyte who would take the knowledge of scientific forestry, bring it across the North Atlantic, and begin to practice what Brandis had practiced in India, in short, to send the message to the New World. That served Pinchot just fine. It suited his ambition no end and no doubt stroked his ego. But he still didn't know what he was talking about. He still had no school to go to, but Brandis solved that problem also. He said, don't study in German. Your German isn't good enough to do that. Go to France. Go to the National Forestry School in Nancy in France. There, study the practice, get your degree, and then return to the United States. And periodically, you will come study with me and go see how forestry is managed in other parts of Europe. Pinchot was fine with that, went to Nancy, began to study, and then recognized two things. He absolutely loved this new profession, and he couldn't stand his fellow students. He couldn't figure out why all they wanted to do was to sit in cafes and smoke cigarettes and chase after women when there was this whole profession that lay before them, a whole new world. For them, it was a job. For Pinchot, it was a mission. And this missionary, and he was a zealous missionary, couldn't figure out why other people didn't share his enthusiasm. But he sort of blew them off and ignored them in a variety of ways, and ultimately decided that he would pursue it on his own because he wasn't going to get much from his peers. He didn't think much of the French teaching methods either. He didn't think that learning French law would help him terribly much in the United States, and he was surely right about that. He didn't feel that the French teachers were particularly profoundly good, and they didn't excite him terribly much, although there were some who captured his imagination. But nonetheless, he understood that they knew things he didn't know. He needed to learn it, and he needed to learn it quickly. While he was in France studying, his parents were sending him letters, and he was writing back to them. Sometimes there were 7 letters delivered in a single day. And one of those letters invariably said, well, why didn't you answer our first letter? Well, it just arrived. How could he have possibly invented it? I mean, if they had had email, they would have been delighted. But this is a slow-moving world of correspondence crossing the North Atlantic through steamship. But his parents were constantly bombarding him with advice and suggestions and information and ways to think about his new profession. And he was posing questions of them. Already in the late 1880s by this point, he was thinking out the possibility of creating a forestry school in the United States, somewhere most likely at Yale, where he had gone to undergraduate work. He was thinking about a forest service that he would help to invent. It was vague at this point, but he was already mapping it out in his mind, and his parents are his best critics. They were arguing with him, shaping him, urging him to think out new ways, and were constantly back in the United States talking with people of influence and power, mostly in the Republican Party, and they were all Republicans, urging them to think about what their son could do when he came home, preparing the way for him in a way that's really quite astonishing when you think about it. But his parents were some of the greatest stage parents I've ever encountered as an historian, and you'll see them set the stage in a variety of arrangements for their son throughout his career and throughout the rest of their lives. This was one example of that. Brandis was also a huge influence. Pinchot periodically went back to Bonn. Brandis insisted that when Pinchot did his homework in Nancy, he was to send copies of it to Brandis so Brandis could check to see whether he was learning as well as he ought to be learning. And it turns out he'd send back letters to him and scolding him in various ways, sort of shaping this young man's education. He was learning a lot in a hurry. But he was a young man in a hurry also. He didn't really want to finish the 2-year course. He wanted to finish a year, cut and run, and get out of there and get back to the United States. And he wanted to because he wanted to found a profession. And he was fearful that someone else would do it before he could. And so he did, in fact, leave after a little more than a year in Europe. Brandes told him, "Don't go, you don't know enough yet," words that would come back to haunt Pinchot in time. But his parents also agreed with him that really there wasn't perhaps not so much that Europe could train him to do because Europe was not the United States. He had two instructive lessons in this regard. On one of his trips to Prussia, he went into a Prussian forest, following an Oberforester, the manager of a forest. And as they walked along this forest, which was laid out in a gridiron fashion as if it were an urban streetscape, he was appalled by the forest as a physical construct, though amazed that someone could build a forest quite like this. But he was even more upset by what he saw as the social relationships that played out in that forest between the forester and those who were his minions, those who were his peons working in the forest. When the forester and Pinchot walked down the pathways between these rows of trees and they came upon a woodchopper, the woodchopper immediately took off his hat, stepped back off of the path, and bowed down before the forester, a kind of deference that no American could have stomached. And Pinchot's looking at this and going, "Oh my God, is this forestry? Is this what this means?" And so was repelled by the sort of monarchical force that seemed to drive both the French, the German, and the Prussian models of forestry, which is why he was thrilled when he went to Switzerland, that democratic state, walked through the forests there, and saw none of that deference being displayed. Learned that it was a set of forests on the communal level and the city level in Zurich and elsewhere, the Schildwald, which is a very famous urban forest in Zurich. He encountered a kind of democratic, locally controlled forest that made sense to this budding Democrat with a small d, who just happened to be a Republican with a large R. And so when he came home and prepared a speech to give actually to the American Economic Association, which had a branch of forestry within it, he wrote a speech that looked at the government's role in forestry throughout Europe. And as he went through each of the countries, he said, the French do this and they do it well, but we're not French. The Germans do these things and they do these things well, but frankly, we're not Germans. And we're not Prussians either, and we're not really English, but the Swiss. Now, the Swiss are great. These are the people we should follow because they really have figured out how to control natural resources in a democratic political system. All of which is fine and good, but there were no democratically controlled forests in the United States. There is no public land that's laying out there that needed him. There were no foresters in the United States, in truth. There was a tiny division of forestry in the Bureau of Agriculture, headed by a renowned German forester, Bernard Fernau, with whom Pinchot was at times friendly and at times at odds, and ultimately their personalities rubbed against one another. From Fernau, Pinchot learned something quite interesting. Fernau did not believe that governmental forestry at the federal level would ever succeed. In fact, before Pinchot went to Europe, Fernau told him, "You know what, you really ought to study biology and other things to fall back on when forestry doesn't work for you." In short, here was the premier forester of the United States saying there would be no forestry in the United States, an odd thing for a man who headed the federal government's branch of forestry to articulate and advocate, but so he did. What Pinchot learned from that was that Fernau was the wrong man. Now, it's logical that he thought so, because Pinchot was ambitious. He wanted Fernau's job, but he did not want to work for Fernau. He didn't want to work for him for lots of reasons, but one of which became clear when they took a trip together into Arkansas in 1891. And they went into the Mississippi Bottomlands area of northeastern Arkansas. And Pinchot learned a ton about southern forests while there, and he also learned a ton about Fernau, which he didn't like. Fernau was, he said, obstreperous. Fernau was, he said, not a very nice man. And he was actually kind of rude, which seems like an odd thing to pick up on. But Pinchot meant by that that he was rude in his personal relationships with people who he felt were lesser than he was. That was manifest in his relationships, apparently, as Pinchot wrote about it, with the working class folks who lived in the backwoods of Arkansas, who Pinchot kind of liked, actually, ate their food, played around with their kids, thought they were, as he put it in his diary, poor white trash. And he meant by that all of the distinctions that were possible, but he also hung out with them and felt somewhat at ease with their world. When they went to Mobile, Alabama, these two men, Fernow and Pinchot, and stayed at the home of Charles Moore, a renowned chemist, but a man that Fernow didn't particularly like, Pinchot was appalled. When Fernow, after they had retired to bed, started undercutting Moore, calling him all sorts of bad names, thinking of him as not a terribly effective scientist and somewhat of a failure as a man. And Pinchot, knowing that he was benefiting from this man that Fernow was cutting down, thought that Fernow's personality was simply the wrong kind of personality to have as the head of the Forest Service, or what would become a Forest Service in the United States, and he made sure to no longer work with Fernow as a consequence of that. Instead, what he decided to do, again because of family connections, was to work at the Biltmore Estate, George Washington Vanderbilt's extraordinary home, being built at that time in the early 1890s outside of Asheville, North Carolina. It was the biggest private home in the United States in the 19th century. It was the biggest private home in the 20th century. It's a massive pile of limestone that is an astonishing piece of real estate, which Pinchot said in his diary at the time that this is a crime against democracy. Now, keep in mind, Pinchot comes from a great deal of wealth, too, but not quite Vanderbilt's wealth. And he thought that that representation, ostentatious representation of wealth, was really the wrong thing for a democratic society to reveal of itself. But he worked for Vanderbilt largely because this was the first ground on which he could do his work as a forester. And here he found out the real hard truth, that he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know what he was doing because, as Brandis had told him, he was only about half trained. And he looked at the landscape in Asheville. It was burned over, cut over, and grazed over. And he wasn't quite sure what, in that context, a forester could do or even should do. And so he wrote letters to his mentors, Brandis included, in Germany and in France. And when he got their replies back, and he read them in French and German and started to think about them, he realized there's another problem. They don't know what to do either because they've never seen a landscape like this. So like any good graduate student, he had reached out to his mentors, asked them for advice, and then recognized their advice didn't matter because it didn't connect with the ecology that he was looking at. So he realized immediately that one of the things he had been talking about for the last 2 years, the creation of an American forestry school, cued to American landscape traditions, was absolutely essential. But there was no such thing. Who was going to found such a thing? Well, Gifford Pinchot had money, so did his parents. And it's at that point that they start to think about how to create a forestry school to produce the foresters who would have the scientific knowledge that, frankly, Gifford Pinchot himself lacked. But that's a little bit in the future. By 1892, 1893, while he was working on Vanderbilt's estate, he decided he needed to go public with the notion that forestry was profitable or could be made profitable to enhance the argument that he would later make that forestry ought to be both national, state, and locally driven on private and public lands. And so thankfully, hopefully, and with great timing, the Columbian Exposition of 1893 that was to be set in Chicago, the great World's Fair of that year, set because, of course, Columbus landed in Chicago, as we all know, was set in the great city of Chicago, and there was going to be a forestry building. And there was going to be a whole set of discussions about forestry there, and Biltmore's estate, because it was one of the grand ventures in forestry, had a section. And so Pinchot began to think about how he wanted to represent what his work had entailed. He wanted to have a book, a pamphlet, it would be called The Biltmore Forest. He also wanted to have forests, photographs of the forest itself, because he intuited, and here's one of his really shrewd moves, he intuited that photography, the image of the photograph, could convey much better to an ignorant population what foresters did and what forestry entailed than any amount of words contained in his book could do. And so this thin pamphlet was filled with photographs, emblems in effect from Western North Carolina that showed what it was he was doing, why he was doing it, and why a population should care about this thing called forestry, which frankly, they didn't know much about yet either. But Pinchot would change that through this book and his later efforts on forestry's behalf. But before we leave that book and that great exhibition in Chicago, it's also clear that the text revealed something about Pinchot as well. It wasn't that he lied exactly. It's that he didn't tell the whole truth about making forestry profitable. Because if you look in the pamphlet, there's a list and an accounting of how much money was made through the forestry efforts that he and his staff pursued. And it says in the text, and the numbers reveal it, that Biltmore, as a forestry enterprise, made money after the first year. But if you start to go down that list, there are things that are missing, most notably his salary. He didn't count his salary in there, and if he counted his salary in there, there would have been no profit. In fact, there would have been a fairly substantial loss. So Biltmore, in effect, is the first low-cost timber sale in the United States, and it's played out in a variety of ways in that text itself. But don't mess with the facts on this one. It's really about the propaganda, in effect, the telling of the story of forestry that really mattered. And it gave Pinchot the notion that if he was going to ultimately be successful in his work, that what he really was very, very deft at is telling the story of forestry, not being a forester himself. And so he left Biltmore, hung out a shingle in New York City, built up a coterie of supporters and a cohort of new people that he could then send off to Europe. In fact, one of his close friends at Yale, a guy by the name of Harry Graves, who would become the second chief of the Forest Service, Pinchot underwrote his education in Germany so that Graves could come join him back in the United States in joining in on this new conservation mission that he was going to launch in and around forestry. And in 1898, when Gifford Pinchot was named the fourth head of the tiny Division of Forestry in the Department of Agriculture, replacing Bernard Fernow, which he had very much wanted to do, he was now in a position to pursue the next stage in his career, that is taking forestry and making it a national agenda. But to do that was difficult. Keep in mind, there are no foresters, there are no forest schools, there is no profession, there is no real journal to which a forester, had there been any, could write an article for. So what do? Step by step, you begin to construct the profession. By 1900, in his living room, he had pulled together the foresters and created the Society of American Foresters. In time, it would become the sponsoring agency for the lead journal of forestry in North America, the Journal of Forestry, and Pinchot served as a guiding light for that journal as well. To create the foresters, for whom there was no school, he and his family gave $250,000 to Yale to endow the school. He asked Harry Graves, his close friend, "Go to Yale, young man, or go back to Yale, young man. I want you to be the dean of this new school. You'll create the curriculum. You will produce the students. But while we're producing these students, we have to have a kind of summer camp for them in which they will get field work. And where are we going to do this? Oh, I have a great idea. How about Milford? And how about on the Pinchot family lands, which just conveniently need to be rehabilitated?" And so generations of foresters went from Yale to Milford to work in the summer camp. Aldo Leopold, the great conservationist himself, also was there to learn there their first skills. And then in other summers, they would take up internships for very little money in the division, now Bureau of Forestry, because it doesn't have a lot of money, but it has a lot of ambition. And it also doesn't have one key thing. It didn't have any forests. All the public forested lands in the United States until 1905 were located in the Department of Interior. All the foresters in the United States were located in the Department of Agriculture. Pinchot was going to have to get those lands into agriculture or move into interior, which he did not wish to do, if these two things were going to come together. But before that happened, he had to find work for all of these young men who were off at Yale, and so he would farm them out to private industry to create new forest plans for all sorts of forest endeavors in Texas and elsewhere, to create the possibilities that there they could get the training, the hands-on training they desperately needed so that they didn't have to go to Germany. Keep that in mind. This is an American training for American foresters in American environmental conditions. That's why Yale was founded. And that founding then produced the young men, the cadre of young men that will ultimately come into the Bureau of Forestry and ultimately serve in the U.S. Forest Service, join the Society of American Foresters, read and publish in the Journal of Forestry, continue their work, embellish their careers, their professions would expand over time. In short, within a very quick period of time. Between 1898 and 1905, in a mere 7 years, he created the profession, he created the work the profession would pursue, he created the curriculum around which the professionals would be trained, he created the licensing agency, the Society of American Foresters. He, in effect, and a cadre of young men, developed this agency, the Forest Service, and the profession itself in a very short period of time. It's an extraordinary accomplishment, but it needed forests in the end to be ultimately successful. And between 1898 and 1905, he schemed with all sorts of influential figures, most notably the President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, to move forests off of and out of the Department of Interior into the Department of Agriculture. It was a critical move. It took 5 to 7 years for it to happen, but in 1905, the laws were passed and signed by Roosevelt that moved those forests over to agriculture, creating the U.S. Forest Service, and then 2 years later, those lands were renamed the National Forests. The name is not an accident. For Pinchot and Roosevelt, these were public lands owned by the nation, not by the states, not by the localities. They would serve the states and they would serve the localities, but this meant that a citizen in New Hampshire was as invested in the Lola National Forest in Missoula as anyone who lived in Missoula might be. And that's a critical part of their success. And it's an important thing for us to remember in an age in which the notion of national forest as nationally controlled by a wide part of the culture is under some attack. But Pinchot, as he understood his work, was not just about the creation of this agency. It was also about the expansion of its efforts around the country on all of these new national forests in Montana and Colorado and Utah and Idaho, California, Oregon, and Washington, and New Mexico and Arizona, for that matter, territories at that point. Doing that was difficult. It meant persuading people who had usually mined and grazed and timbered on those lands for free that now they had to pay a fee. They had to abide by law, which they didn't particularly want to do. But it's not just that Pinchot was persuasive. He found the most persuasive capacity in this process to be taking people to court, because a court decision set precedent which allowed the Forest Service now to articulate that this land is inside National Forest and that land over there isn't, but inside here you have to listen to our regulations. So that not only does he create the profession, but he creates the legal mechanism by which that profession could pursue its work continuously and without disruption across time. A remarkable accomplishment in a very short period of time. Perhaps more striking, though, is that he was able to do this, and perhaps significantly able to do this, because of his close relationship with Teddy Roosevelt. Roosevelt believed, as did Pinchot, that good progressives, with capital P's, advocated the efficient scientific understanding of the world, that you could change the world because human agency allowed us to do so. It's a very George Perkins Marsh notion that human beings have the capacity to be stewards as long as we were stewards and as long as we pursued that initiative. And so in that way, Pinchot and Roosevelt now are creating the national system that Marsh had imagined in 1865, 1866, when his book came out. But they went beyond Marsh because then they had to deal with the issues on the ground. And the issues on the ground are tough. Pinchot, for example, called grazing the bloody angle. This was the central issue of the American West, not cutting timber. That would not be an issue until really the 1950s. The real issue was livestock. And livestock, as it turns out, tends to destroy landscapes. And so the big fight was, how do you control grazing without destroying the livestock industry? That was a tough, tough sell. I'm not sure that Pinchot felt he fully resolved that issue during his term as the first chief of the Forest Service. And in any event, his term in the Forest Service was cut short when he came to blows, in a figurative sense, with the President of the United States, the new President of the United States, William Howard Taft. Teddy Roosevelt had left office in 1908. Taft was his hand-picked successor. And Pinchot, who worked with Taft, began to sense that Taft didn't share Roosevelt and Pinchot's missionary sense that the executive branch, and the Forest Service is part of that branch, really had new constitutional ground to forge. That is to say, that it was beginning to enact law and rule in the West in ways that had never been done before. Taft was leery of that. He was much more conservative than they were, and that's why he and Pinchot start to come to get to odds with one another. The context in which this flowed out revolved around Alaska coal mines. There were coal claims in Alaska, which Pinchot came to understand the Taft administration might be, and they were certain in Pinchot's mind, to be doing, letting those coal mines go to private industry. In a short, taking a public object, a public resource, and giving it over to the private industry. Pinchot was opposed to that, as he had been with timber companies and the like, and so started to raise a stink. He was subtle at first, but he became more and more obvious in his opposition to the Taft administration's actions. So obvious that when he had a private interview with the President of the United States, he warned the President in 1909 that perhaps the President would have to fire him. Not yet, perhaps, but it was going to come soon because Pinchot wasn't going to shut up, and he wasn't going to shut up because this was an issue of the public interest, and he felt the administration was violating that interest. Sure enough, Pinchot would be fired in 1910. And he was thrilled by his firing. He was thrilled for a couple of reasons. First of all, it gave him a kind of martyr complex, let's be honest about that. It allowed him to claim to have fought the good fight and gone down in flames. He was thrilled for it also because it forced the issue about conservation and made it clear to a public that was astonished by the fight that erupted around these coal claims in Alaska, that the administration could actually consider getting rid of the public trust and ignoring it and sending this coal into private hands without any public discussion. Finally, it came a great moment for Pinchot because he was able to go to Europe, meet with Teddy Roosevelt, who had been off busy shooting animals in Africa, and encourage him to come back to the United States, enter into the political terrain, and begin to run a campaign against Taft for the 1912 election. And as you recall, three men ran for president in 1912. Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat, William Howard Taft, the Republican, and ultimately Teddy Roosevelt on the Bull Moose ticket, a third party. Each man proclaimed himself to be a progressive. Each man claimed himself to be a conservationist, and the fight was on. But the end result of the fight was that Roosevelt and Taft split the Republican vote and Wilson came into the White House. But the real blow, the body blow that came for Taft was that he came in third. Name a sitting president, whoever came in third, well, you can't do it. And that tells you something really important. Don't mess with GIF. The guy had clout. And it turns out that that then set Roosevelt and Pinchot off on a crusade, and Pinchot even more than Roosevelt for the rest of his life, that argued that conservation was in fact a radical initiative designed to do two things, to repair the landscape and also to repair human society. It was absolutely crucial to Pinchot that these two things come combined, that environmental support or support for the environment had to come twined with social justice. He had argued that as the Forest Service chief, but it becomes ever more important to him when he went into the political arena himself. He would run for office periodically in Pennsylvania, running for Senate between the teens, right up till his death, virtually. He never got into the Senate, but he did serve Pennsylvania admirably as governor for two terms, in the 1920s and in the 1930s. And in those administrations, we see some of the very first environmental legislation around water quality and stream flow of any administration in the United States, well in advance of the federal government, by the way. In Pennsylvania, under Pinchot's administration, the first multi-state environmental agreements around the Ohio River were first fashioned. He was using the expertise that he had developed as the head of the Forest Service in a national arena and bringing it down to the state level to repair certain kinds of environmental problems that were emerging in the midst of the Industrial Revolution. And trust me, the Ohio River was about as devastated a river as possible to exist. And Pinchot, who was a great fisherman, one of the great fishermen of his generation, believed in clear streams because he loved fish. But he knew that he could use his power as the chief executive of Pennsylvania to fashion a new kind of an agenda for the communities that relied on that remarkable watershed in Ohio and Pennsylvania. He also, in his second term, came to a whole new realization about the power of a chief executive within a state. Pennsylvania was one of the great industrial states in the country, and it was devastated by the Depression. large unemployment, among the highest unemployment in the United States. Pinchot re-entered the governorship of Pennsylvania at exactly that moment. And he did two things immediately. One was to tell the state road department, throw away your machine and start hiring men to build roads. The more men we can hire, the more wages we can give. The more wages we give, we'll have a modest impact on the economy. We'll sustain these individual lives, but also start to regenerate some of the economic activity in the state. And still today, the roads they built to pull the farmers out of the mud, which was Pinchot's model for what he was doing, they are still called Pinchot roads to this very day. The other thing he did was to look around the state and recognize that all of the lumber companies that had managed to survive through the 20s, and there weren't many of them, were now going belly up. They were dumping their land, they were unable to sell their land, and what he would then use was state monies to buy up cheap forest land and then hire unemployed workers to go onto those lands and replant them. The goal was to make Penn's woods green again. And if you fly over Pennsylvania today, and you look at the remarkable level of state forest in that commonwealth, it is in fact a part of Pinchot's policy that we now see flourishing in a natural sense. But it also was always bound up with, in both those roads and those forests, with social equity. We have to make the working man and working woman's lives better, or otherwise, no matter what we do, we have failed. Now you would say, well, of course, this is about politics and he wants to get reelected, but it turns out it's not about reelection because he could not replace himself. He could only serve a term and leave office, so he's not interested in furthering his career in that respect because there was no further career to have. He built a coalition of women, of labor, of the marginalized, the unemployed, and the like. He's a Republican. When did a Republican ever do this? Rarely, if ever. But that's what he had to work with, and he responded to their needs. These were the most destitute, the most forgotten. And when Roosevelt became president, he asked Pinchot for a memorandum that would lay out what Pinchot had done in Pennsylvania. And the Civilian Conservation Corps, the much-touted CCC, flows directly out of Pinchot's experimentation in Pennsylvania in the 1930s. His political career would continue, or at least his attempts to enhance his political career would continue, but the good citizens of Pennsylvania never reelected him to an office. That didn't stop Pinchot from thinking, though, about the relationship between environments and equity. In fact, what it does is to allow him in the latter part of the 1930s to begin to think out a new way to imagine the world, not Pennsylvania, not the United States. The source of that reimagination was World War II. In September 1st, 1939, Hitler sent his forces into Poland, setting off World War II. Pinchot began to think about World War III at exactly that moment. As he argued in an essay in Nature in 1940, World War II was being driven by natural resources and the need for depressed industrial states to secure resources at the cheapest price possible. Look at what the Japanese did in the early 1930s when they went into Manchuria. He said they were going after coal. They could say they were going after other things, but they were really going after coal. Look at what the Germans did in the latter part of the 1930s when they went into Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. They said they were going there because there were other Germans, but actually what they were going is coal and into the Ruhr Valley for the same reason. And Pinchot's argument in 1940 was, we're going to have World War III if we don't resolve and figure out how to distribute natural resources equitably, not just to the industrial states, but to the poor states. Much as he argued about the unemployed in Pennsylvania in the early 1930s, he will now argue in the late 30s that we cannot have a sane global policy unless we think about those who are the most depressed, the most distressed, and who have the least. So he made a proposition that we should have a UN-like organization whose job it would be to monitor, regulate, and control the distribution of natural resources globally so that major corporations, which Pinchot didn't really like, could not dominate resource use and absorb wealth and distribute it to those who already had a lot. The whole goal of this organization was to make sure that social equity, social justice, must be done, because if it isn't done, then the poor and the dispossessed are going to rise up and battle with the rich. And we're going to continually see warfare disturb the nations of this world. Those who support Greenpeace, for example, may not claim Gifford Pinchot as one of their progenitors, but they need to, because he understood the relationship between green and peace, that there would be no global peace until there was a realization that environmental justice, in its broadest sense, was a critical part of human life. He had made those claims as a Forest Service chief. He made those claims as a governor of Pennsylvania. He would make those claims towards the end of his life. And towards its conclusion, wrote in his remarkable autobiography, Breaking New Ground, some of the strongest attacks upon corporate America I have ever seen written by anyone, let alone somebody who grew up as wealthy as Pinchot had done. But he understood that the emergence of what we now know as multinational corporations that have no connection to any nation state was in fact a detriment because it left out the public regardless of country. The people have to have a voice. They must have that voice or the society that they wish to live in will not exist. And that's one of Pinchot's claims. I should tell you that when he read part of that chapter out to the Washington chapter of the Society of American Foresters in 1945, they were ticked off. They stormed out. They were very upset with him for having so said because, frankly, they understood, and they were right about this, that his claims were radical. We don't tend to think about foresters being radical, but there was a coterie of them in the 1930s, and Pinchot was amongst them, one of the driving forces. Bob Marshall was another, Raphael Zahn was a third, who understood in ways that I think is quite relevant to us that questions of environmental justice must come paired with a rehabilitated landscape, a flow of economic goods off of the national forest, the public lands, that would make all life better, not just a few lives better. And when he died, he carried that energy with him, I'm sorry to say, because by the close of his life, as he argued for an international conference, talked to Roosevelt before he died, Roosevelt loved the idea, except he then died. So he then had to convince Truman to do this, and Truman ultimately did it, creating a United Nations conference around conservation, to which Gifford Pinchot's wife, Cornelia Bryce Pinchot, herself a feminist and a very influential force on her husband's life, gave one of the keynote addresses. And she lambasted this organization because they had totally dropped the issue of social issues from their agenda. All they were interested in the technology of conservation. They had no interest in the sort of social and democratic forces that Pinchot felt must be unleashed at war's end, or we would suffer another war. She also argued later, when Gifford Pinchot National Forest was created in the late 1940s, that one of her husband's greatest strengths was to recognize that subsequent generations following his would have to achieve their own understanding of conservation because they encountered a world that was unlike his. In short, he said, conservation matters enormously, but you don't have to follow my version because my version has to evolve. And that's captured in the dictum that he wrote in 1907 that really sort of shapes much of his understanding of the world ever since. The greatest good for the greatest number for the longest time. The greatest good for the greatest number was an old term, a utilitarian term coined by Jeremy Bentham, an 18th century English economist. But Pinchot added for the longest time. He didn't know the word sustainability, but that's what he was talking about. And sustainability is something that has to evolve over time. But that means the land has to be repaired so that human life can be made better. And that's what he meant by the greatest good for the greatest number for the longest time.